Now, Aldus and his friend Erasmus knew exactly what the printing press was really for. So in 1516 is an interesting date for people who like the history of printing. So that was the first year, remember this is like 76 years after the printing press was first introduced into Europe. There were almost 100,000 presses in Europe by that time. Nobody had ever put page numbers in a book until 1516. Think about that for a second. There are no page numbers in manuscripts in the regular Occidental culture. If somebody's interested, I'll mention the exception to this, which was in the Jewish culture in the Middle Ages. But in the Occidental culture, there are no page numbers in any books, and not in any printed books until 75 years after the invention of the printing press. Now, why is that? Well, didn't they need them for sequencing? No, because the way they sequenced books was to write on the bottom of a page the next two words from the next page. And if you look at an old book, and I have some books from the 18th century that have pagers numbered in them but are still sequenced that way. So those two little words are down there. So they could very quickly look to see if the pages were sorted. So for sequencing, you didn't need page numbers. And the page numbers were not used for referring to a page in some book in some other town. And the reason is that each town had its own press, and virtually all the books in a town were printed in that town. So a typical press run was about 2,000 books. So why did they put page numbers in? Well, Erasmus and Aldus and a couple of other people realized if we put page numbers into books, we can refer to things in the book that the person who's reading it is holding right now. In other words, we can refer back to something that we already said. And they can go back there, and we know exactly what page that is on because we proofed those galleys. And so this very simple form of hyperlinking started getting invented. Tables of contents started being put in. They weren't put into original books. Indexes started being put in, and those were a way of allowing a stronger set of arguments to be done in the material that a person had. So the amount of time it takes for people to start realizing the potential of a medium takes much, much, much longer than most people think. So let me finish this by just mentioning a couple of ideas that we're actually trying to do here. So one of the things that we've noticed as we go around the world, watching children happily, children love computers. This is something that was discovered in the 60s. And as Papert pointed out, children instinctively know what it is that they are doing is a real form of adult activity, not a fake form. How they know that, I'm not sure. But they take to it the way they take to Tinker Toy, serious block building apparatus. They know they can make things with it. And so Papert had a wonderful insight that because he was a mathematician and had also spent 5 years with Piaget, Papert realized that the way of thinking of a child, what we think as a becoming narcissism that is so wonderful in a 4 or 5 year old child and so annoying in a 45-year-old child. But the narcissism of a child makes them the center of their universe. Everything is related to them. And Papert, being a mathematician, realized, oh yeah, that's like differential geometry, which had been invented by Carl Gauss in the 19th century as a way of dealing with complex things like curves and other geometric relationships without reference to any external coordinate system. So remember, we had Descartes with the x and y coordinate system, and everything was related to that. And the problem was when science came in, nobody could find where 0, 0, 0 was in the universe. So everywhere you looked in the universe, it seemed to go off forever, maybe wrapping around, but there didn't seem to be any preferred center. And the universe was big. So picking some faraway star as a reference point gave you all these big numbers for coordinates. So Gauss started thinking about, calculus allows us to find out what's similar and what's different about a whole bunch of things. So a very interesting thing is if you take a line that's sloped this way and you start asking what's similar and what's different, you find out that there's only one little thing that's different, and that's how far it goes up when you go over a little bit. And that is the same for a line, no matter how you pick over. Right? So the ratio of how far you go up for how far you go over is always the same, because it's a triangle. The triangle has the same shape, different sizes. So that was pretty cool. So you come up with one number that expresses a zillion points in this line, and one other number will serve to locate this line relative to something else, and so two numbers is all you need for this line. So Gauss was very happy with that, and the next thing he did was to look at curves, and the same thing is true. If you take a parabola and do that same process to it once, you get a line. And because you have a line, you can do it twice, and you wind up with a couple of numbers, and that's all you need to generate everything in that parabola. And then you start thinking about other things. So a circle, for example. This is the famous first thing that we do, which goes all the way back to Seymour Papert's circle, which is get a five-year-old to do a circle, get them to close their eyes, and they will just make one. And the reason is they are not worrying about where zero is. They're not having to find a compass somewhere and measure the distance from the center. What they're doing is instinctively realizing that a circle is a thing that has constant curvature. So if I go a little and turn a little, I'm going to absolutely get a circle. And this is just what Carl Gauss found out about circles, is if you look at them from the standpoint of being on the circle and what happens next, it is incredibly simpler to model the entire circle with just this one little idea. So Papert, being a mathematician, realized that this is the child's coordinate system, and furthermore, that little thing, that little incremental thing that's happening, there is a simple addition, sometimes of a directed thing. Maybe you're adding little arrows in there, and all of a sudden, Seymour realized, hey, we have a way of teaching 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds the math of differential geometry, which just happens to be the mathematics that science uses for most of its things. And you can do it without any algebra, because the computer is able to remember where you are in this thing, and by iterating it over and over again, it actually not only integrates that differential equation, it shows you the result of that as it goes along. So that was the basis of my getting interested in this stuff in 1968, when I saw it was going on. I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen, still do. And what was interesting and horrifying was how quickly this idea got turned into a dial tone by the great low-pass filter of life when LOGO came into the world. And the reason was that virtually none of the early adopter teachers had ever taken calculus or knew anything about this. And by the way, if you take high school calculus, you do not learn differential geometry. The problem is it's all based on the Cartesian coordinate system. And a circle is an x squared plus y squared equals r squared. And the differential equation of that in those terms is so messy they don't even put it into high school calculus books. So the mismatch here from just different ways of looking at important mathematics and the ways that school tries to teach mathematics is enormous before you even bring the computer into the scene. So it would be, and when people worry about why aren't people using the computer for more of these good ideas, I say, well, wait a minute. Math and science became really important in our culture in the middle to the late 17th century. And we haven't successfully put those into our elementary school classrooms yet. Don't worry about the computer. The computer's only been around for 50 years. We're talking about something that is really important. In fact, most schools are still struggling with getting kids to read printed books. Right? So that's been around for 600 years now. And schools are having a difficult time getting kids fluent in them. So the take-up of these powerful ideas into the general population and into the general schooling, I think, is a very, very difficult thing. And we have to respect the difficulty of it. But on the other hand, if we don't actually make an attempt at the real thing, we basically wind up with just another 21st century version of air guitar. And basically, our culture is an air guitar culture. Because what marketing people generally are trying to sell people is the illusion and fantasy of actually being able to do something, whether it's being a race car driver or you know, the iPod ads, that you're actually a participant in something that a professional participates in. Except in the case of computing, when you're doing desktop publishing, you are doing what a professional does. But in the case of the iPod air with air guitar, you're not doing what the professional does. You're just doing an illusion, a dream. And so the disparity between these two is getting more and more critical. And if we look at American schools with a critical eye, in fact, schools in most places in the world, we see air guitar everywhere. I have a degree in mathematics, and I cannot find real mathematics in elementary school education. And of course, there are exceptions. One of the greatest exceptions I've ever seen was a school teacher that we ran into in first grade at the open school years ago, Julia Nishijima. And she was a natural mathematician. She was the real thing. And she was a first grade teacher. And we saw what first graders can really do when you have that combination of a teacher who can teach young children and who actually understands the content. It's unbelievable. And I think this is true in every case where this happens. But by and large, the